This is Night Call, the first and only nationwide listener call-in show on vital issues. Tonight's subject, what sort of law to maintain what sort of order? Tonight's guest, professional American revolutionary Tom Hayden, a co-founder of the Students for a Democratic Society. Night Call is your program. Share your opinions and ideas with the rest of the country. Speak for yourself and ask your questions directly by calling Night Call in New York City from anywhere in North America. Here are Night Call's special phone numbers. From the East and Midwest, call collect at area code 212-749-3311. From the West at 212-749-3357. And from the New York area at 866-5010. Now from New York City, Night Call's host, Del Shields.
Good evening. Tonight we welcome another new station to the Night Call Network, KOA-FM in Denver, Colorado, and we say welcome. Tom Hayden, at the age of 28, is a professional revolutionary, dedicated to the curtailment of American power abroad and the destruction of a system that he feels victimizes the black and the poor at home. In the last 8 years, he has been on every barricade, often leading the charge. Integration in the South and black power in the North. Banning the bomb. Ending the war. Resisting the draft. A trip to Hanoi. And reforming the university. Somehow, Tom Hayden has survived. As co-founder of the SDS, the Students for Democratic Society, Hayden claims that he became a revolutionary in bits and stages. That he didn't learn his radicalism from books, but rather that life in America in the 1960s made him a revolutionary. At the same time that Mr. Hayden is trying to lead a revolution, a great many other Americans are crying out for law and order. Does this mean that Tom Hayden and his followers are headed for an inevitable clash with law and the order forces? Or just how far will each side go, and how violent will it get in working for its goals? Tom Hayden is standing by in San Francisco to answer your questions about social change, the SDS, and law and order. Mr. Hayden, good evening, sir.
How are you? Good evening.
Fine, thank you, and thank you for being with us. Mr. Hayden, we'll begin our conversation tonight with this question. Can we have law and order and still achieve some of the social reforms you feel are essential?
Well, it depends on whether law and order really is kind of a phrase that kind of covers up people's desire to prevent change altogether. If law and order means establishing some kind of peaceful way for people to get what they want, then there isn't that much of a problem. But for a young person who faces the draft, faces the university, faces the war in Vietnam, and is without voting power in this society, that machinery for peaceful change doesn't really exist.
Is violence necessary in order to bring about the changes?
Well, that's never decided by the people who want the changes. That's always decided by the people who are trying to control things as they are. And if you look at Vietnam, you see that the United States government, at least, is willing to go a very long way into violence to prevent people from having some control over their own communities. And if you look at the reaction to the black power movement and freedom movement in the United States, you see that while a lot of meaningless laws have been passed and a lot of books have been written and a lot of reports have been filed in Washington, whenever conflict gets really sharp, the United States government comes in with troops and military machinery, kills 20 or 30 people, leaves several hundred wounded and 1,000 or 2 in jail, and then things go back to normal. And this country probably hasn't even spent the amount of money on social reform in the last 4 years that it has spent on bolstering up its police force.
Mr. Hayden, why did you see Chicago as an ideal place to confront the establishment?
Chicago was the scene of the Democratic Convention, and we remembered 1964 all too well when Lyndon Johnson ran for president on a platform of peace in Vietnam, no further escalation of the war. And a lot of people believed him, and he was overwhelmingly elected. And it turned out that virtually as quickly as he got into the White House, he started the expansion of the war with the bombing of North Vietnam. And we felt that a similar situation was in the works in the 1968 elections, that the Democratic Party would attempt to put on the mask of peace in order to fool the public and then escalate the war in 1969. So we wanted to make sure that it was clear all around that there was at least some people, especially students, who were not going to see 1964 repeated. They were going to rip the mask off of Johnson and Humphrey and the rest of the Democrats and show that behind the mask there was nothing but the same old closed-minded, authoritarian kind of person who was unable to tolerate any kind of challenge to his authority or any kind of change in his policies. So Chicago was a perfect point at which to confront with demonstrations the government.
Did you make your point?
Well, that's up to you. Do you think we did?
Well, we'll ask our listeners.
Yeah, well, I'd rather put it to them.
All right, our conversation tonight, what sort of law to maintain and what sort of order? That's our conversation tonight. Our guest calling in from San Francisco is professional American revolutionary Tom Hayden, a co-founder of the Students for a Democratic Society. And a reminder to our listeners that Night Call is your show, and the sooner you call in with your questions or your comments, the better the chance you have to get on the air with them. So if you're calling in from the East and the Midwest, you may call us collect at area code 212-749-3311. That's area code 212-749-3311. If you're calling from the West Coast, it's area code 212-749-3357. That's area code 212-749-3357. And if you're calling us locally in New York, it's 866-5010. That's 866-5010. We'll take our first call tonight from Bloomington, Indiana. Mr. Stern is hearing Night Call over WFIU-FM. Mr. Stern?
Yes.
Good evening, sir. Your question?
Yes. My question basically stems from an ambivalence towards the movement as such. While I'm in agreement with what you say concerning Vietnam, I'm critical of your discussions of university reforms. Seems to me that the SDS and other groups around the country at colleges are asking for such things as an end to ROTC and the end of Army recruiting on campuses. But doesn't this seem just another form of censorship, one group telling others what they can do and what they can't do?
I wouldn't call it censorship. I would say that the not only are we trying to get different policies adopted in the universities, like those you're speaking of, but we're trying to change the way in which policies are decided upon so that censorship would not be the result. Democracy would be the result. That we want a university in which it's possible for the primary people, the students and the faculty, to make decisions about programs, about curriculum, about investments, rather than having those decisions made by the state legislature or the board of trustees, which tends to represent business and military and political interests rather than educational ones. So it's not a matter of trying to put one minority in the place of another. It's a matter of trying to change the way the university is run to allow more participation from within it.
But if a student wishes to take an Army ROTC program, should he be allowed to?
I think that should be decided in some way or another by the students. My personal opinion would be no, that ROTC should, that is, the training for the military, should be done off the campus. It's quite easy for a young person who wants that training to get it in other ways besides bringing it into the university. We think in general that the military should have no relationship to the university, but should remain outside the university.
Thank you.
So you're not taking his right to training away, you're just trying to arrange it so that that training is not supported by the university. I'm sure the military can find other buildings and other places to conduct its classes.
Thank you for calling, sir.
Thank you.
This is Night Call in New York. Tonight, our conversation, what sort of law to maintain and what sort of order. Our guest calling in from the West Coast is Mr. Tom Hayden, a co-founder of the Students for a Democratic Society. This time out to Omaha, Nebraska. Mr. Cornell is hearing Night Call over KBON. Mr. Cornell?
Yes, hi there. Right?
Fine, thank you. How are you?
Good, mighty fine. Mighty fine.
Your question, sir.
Ready?
Yes, sir.
This fine gentleman that's speaking to us tonight, excuse me, two items, if you please, sir. One is ROTC, where apparently he does not believe in ROTC. The second one is the draft. He would, correct me if I'm wrong, he would not have the draft. He doesn't believe in the draft. Well, the draft didn't bother some of us, didn't bother me any at all. I never came in contact with it, but I did serve two times in my life in World War I and World War II in combat. I was not drafted either time. But during my course of duty as in the military, I might say this for your listening audience, that I had the occasion to accept ROTC young officers in military service along with recruits. And I'd like to say to the nation tonight that the ROTC boys were head and shoulders above in ability and every way you could imagine, and did so much more to help win these two wars than anything you could shake a stick at. So if you'll please accept that the way I've given it to you, I'd appreciate it.
All right. Now, what is your question, sir?
My question is, what is wrong with the draft law?
Mr. Hayden?
Well, there are a lot of things wrong with the draft law. For instance, the average age of people on the draft boards is 58. One out of five people on the draft boards is 73 years old or older. They tend to be people who believe in the glory of military life. In the southern United States, they tend to be primarily all white. In addition to the irregularities such as these, the draft boards exercise tremendous power, we think, over a fundamental decision that should never be taken away from the individual, and that is the decision about when and where you'll give your life. In a country that preaches individualism, though it doesn't practice it very much, I'm surprised to hear those who favor individualism favoring the draft also, because I think that the draft is the crucial test in a society of whether or not individuals have some kind of right to make fundamental decisions. And our objection is that if you feel as a young person, black, white, college, non-college, if you feel that the war in Vietnam is not a war that you would give your life for, or that you would support, not a war in which you'd want to kill or be killed, then there's no alternative for you but to go to jail or to leave the United States. And there should be an alternative. The alternative should be that people who morally or politically disagree with the war, not because they believe in God, or not, but because they don't believe in the war, they should be allowed not to serve. Otherwise, you're just doing what all conservatives and all true Americans are supposed to be opposed to. That is, allowing the state, allowing the big government to make basic decisions over where you're going to die.
Let me say something, please, sir, my good man, and you are a good man. All true Americans. If I'm not a true American, who are you to sit back there in New York and tell me what I am out here? I have volunteered twice. What would you do to raise an army when Hitler was on the rampage? Would you kick out the draft? Would you have done that in those days?
Well, during World War II, I would imagine that the volunteers were much higher than they are during the war in Vietnam. I'm primarily for an army that's based on voluntary support. I mean, I don't think that you're in good position if you have to sort of press gang or force people into the army in order to fight a war. That shows that there's something lacking in your own society.
Yeah, in my own society. Are you a veteran by chance?
No.
Have you served your country in uniform?
Of course not.
Of course not.
Yeah. Where would I serve it in honor?
No, I don't think there's a place for you in the United States Army. I wouldn't have a fellow like you in a regiment of mine if it was the last man on earth. That's all. Good night. Get off the air.
Thank you for calling, sir. Thank you. This is Night Call in New York. Our conversation tonight, what sort of law to maintain, what sort of order. Our guest tonight, Mr. Tom Hayden, calling in from San Francisco, will return to our guest following station identification. Stay tuned for the Night Call Network.
More Night Call with Del Shields and guest professional revolutionary Tom Hayden after station identification.
What do I really want? Well, the same things any man wants, black or white. I want a decent job. The same chance as any man to better myself, to get ahead. I want a home my wife won't be ashamed of. I want our kids to grow up as proud of being black as of being American. I want to be able to give them what they want, and maybe a little extra. If I don't get all the things I want, it should be because I failed, pure and simple. Not because I'm black. I want nothing more than anyone else, but nothing less either.
It isn't easy to get by in the city these days, for blacks or whites. Our cities need help, your help. If you think there's nothing you can do to help, think harder. Send for the free booklet, The Turning Point. Write Night Call, Pomona, New York. That's Night Call, Pomona, New York. Ask your own questions direct. Speak for yourself, collect from anywhere in North America to guest Tom Hayden about law and order. Call Night Call Collect from the East and Midwest on area code 212-749-3311. From the West on area code 212-749-3357. And from the New York area on 866-5010. Again, Del Shields.
And we return to our guest, Mr. Tom Hayden, calling in from San Francisco as we continue our conversation tonight, what sort of law to maintain and what sort of order. This time out to Seattle, Washington, Mr. Komar is hearing Night Call over KULW-FM. Mr. Komar?
Hello there, sir.
Good evening, sir.
Good evening. I would like to discuss this question, which is brought up on tonight's program, and offer a couple of observations on what I think are necessary tenets of any sort of an order-keeping force. And I do think that you'd agree that, regrettably, in society as it is today, order of some sort has to be enforced by some sort of a force. And I do think that this force is a force which is made up of people who are performing what they might consider to be a regrettable duty and a regrettable job and sometimes an unpleasant one. And I think that it may be quite unrealistic to expect that this force might be manned simply by volunteers. I feel that perhaps, regrettably so, the draft might very well be a lesser of two evils and would be necessary.
Mr. Hayden, your response?
How would it be the lesser of two evils, Mr. Comer?
Well, I think that there, one of the evils, of course, would be forcing someone to serve in a force which he doesn't want to serve in, whether it be for moral reasons or for reasons of simple not desiring to want to participate simply out of convenience or something, or for any number of other reasons perhaps. That's one evil. The other evil is the consequence of not having a force which is able to uphold order in a time and in an age in which order needs to be upheld for the protection of innocent people. And I think that we need a force to uphold an order, and I think that Membership upon such a force, whether it be a police force, whether it be an army, is undesirable membership. I know I wouldn't want to be a part of it, and I think that we may, as a society, be forced to call people to membership in this force through some means other than volunteering.
Well, I could see a mixture of volunteers plus the draft, but I would come down very hard on the idea that a person who morally or politically objects to fighting in the war should not be made to serve. Otherwise, you're taking away his right to decide where he's going to give his life, and that's not for the state to decide.
Yeah, of course, we have a lot of problems here now. You've got to decide who is just the person who is going to pass upon this moral judgment. First of all, you have the moral judgment on the part of the person who feels that for one reason or another, he does not want to serve, or perhaps he might not consider it serving, but he does not want to be a part of the force, in other words. Then you have the role of the draft board or somebody who has to decide whether this person has a sincere moral objection, or if this person simply wants to get out of an unpleasant duty, which he actually morally has nothing against.
Yeah, well, as a temporary way to begin, I'd say that could be left to the draft board under some kind of uniform standards across the country. I think it's possible to distinguish between a person who's sincere and who isn't. They already do that, but the categories are too narrow. They only allow you conscientious objector status if you're a member of an official church of some kind. And I'm really talking about widening that category to go beyond membership in a traditional church like the Quakers to include some kind of activity that obviously you've been engaged in for a long time, in which your convictions are on record, which shows that you simply don't believe in this war and this kind of foreign policy, and that therefore shouldn't be called upon to serve. There's a more basic question, though, besides the question of who's to decide whether the individual goes to war, and that's the question of how does this country make its decisions to get into a war? You can approach it from that angle, too. And our problem in America, I think, is that the way our country was set up, we didn't really plan on having extensive entanglements and foreign relations, and we don't have a real sound way for the public to be informed beforehand and participate in the making of foreign policy decisions. There's a lot of opportunity, complicated and twisted as it is, for people to be involved in decisions in their neighborhood or their cities, counties, state governments, federal governments, but not in foreign policy. Just in this national election, you see that no one had a way to vote on whether they were for or against the Vietnam War. It just wasn't presented to the voters, and decisions about what will be done in Vietnam will be made by the State Department or the Pentagon or the White House.
Yes, I understand everything that you're saying, and you're touching upon a very complex problem, and it's a problem of government theory and just how can the people most efficiently be represented by a government.
I don't think it's that complicated. Of course, there is
no perfect system at all. The truest sense of democracy is just not practical in a country of 180 million people, and there has to be some sort of representation system.
We don't have
and
one.
I think it's almost impossible to devise some sort of a representation
system. Decided upon. Decided upon the engagement in the war in Vietnam. Johnson ran in 1964 in a program of no further escalation against Goldwater, who advocated military solution. The people voted 2 or 3 to 1 for Johnson.
Yes.
Now that's a pretty crude and clear democratic mandate.
Of course, that perhaps was not the major issue in the campaign. The issue in the campaign and the thoughts of many people was simply the issue of personality, the personality of Goldwater, and what was considered to be his irresponsibility in the handling of nuclear weapons.
Well, I'd agree that that
perhaps could have been the major issue which superseded the Vietnamese question
entirely.
That's
part of it, but you're only underscoring my point, which is that there is no very meaningful way that people can register what they think about foreign policy.
Oh, that's
Mr. Komar? Mr. Komar? Mr. Komar, thank you so much for calling, sir.
By the State Department and not particularly by the people. I mean, you ask the average American, what's Vietnam 5 years ago? He wouldn't know what part of the world Vietnam was in. And yet we were carrying out a steady escalation of the war leading to our present involvement there.
All right, Mr. Hayden, we'll take our next call from Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Mr. Taylor is hearing Night Call of WTMJ. Mr. Taylor?
Good evening, Mr. Hayden.
Good evening, sir.
First off, I'd like to preface any remark or question I make by saying I am a university man. I'm also a veteran. And in my younger day, I was as idealistic as I believe many of the young people today are. But I have found so far that peace does not necessarily beget peace. In other words, while I may want to shake the other fellow's hand, he quite possibly has already clenched his fist and is about to, deliver a pretty forceful blow in his behalf, not mine, believe me. And I often wonder then, if peace really begets peace, wouldn't we have been better off? And I say we in the editorial sense, as people generally, if we rent, for example, in the case of the Democratic Convention, Soldiers Field, and approach Mayor Daley from that standpoint. I think if that field were bulging with young people who were really speaking out in what they believe is a true philosophy of how to accomplish peace and law and order, we can kind of equate this thing with the highways today. If everybody was a rule and a law unto himself, our highways would be even a greater mess than they are. And the man that drives 90 miles an hour, considerably over the 65-mile-an-hour speed limit, is certainly making himself a law unto himself, regardless of my car, my driving, my family.
Well, the fact of the matter, Mr. Taylor, is that the several organizations engaged in the Chicago protest applied for several weeks, in fact months, for permits. And one of the organizations...
Permits for what, sir?
Asked for a permit for the use of Soldiers Field.
Yes.
This was an organization of young Democratic Party workers who were supporters of either Bobby Kennedy or Senator McCarthy. They were turned down by Mayor Daley. They went to the courts where the judge ruled against their being given the permits. The judge happened to be Mayor Daley's former law partner, but I suppose he's the man of independent mind. And the situation, therefore, was that there was no way to get permits for rallies or marches or parades or assemblies.
Soldiers Field was far enough from the convention hall that certainly it shouldn't have interfered had they permitted it, I'm certain. I'm wondering.
Yeah, well, they didn't want anybody coming to Chicago.
Well, I suppose that was the transportation and logistics and general accumulation of humanity that they didn't feel they were prepared for. But I'm thinking back now to World War II when we let loose of things by the very fact that everybody bombarded the congressmen with baby shoes. And as a result, we brought our troops home much too soon to really stabilize what we felt was going to be a lasting peace. And my copy of One World is pretty well dog-eared for the very fact that I can't constantly go back to reread certain parts of it because I felt that Mr. Wilkie and, the allies of World War II were interested truly in peace and the opportunity for humanity, wherever it might be, to have a better opportunity to live and have what God has provided here in such abundance for all of us to enjoy. But we didn't stay long enough. And under the circumstances, we do have the problem of wars with us, which constantly move us closer and closer to a situation where you have to choose sides. And when you start choosing sides, the war
sides between what?
Larger.
Mr. Taylor, I want to thank you for calling. We have to break for station identification.
Thank you.
Thank you so much, sir. This is Night Call in New York. We return to our guest, Mr. Tom Hayden, following station identification. Stay tuned for the Night Call Network.
More Night Call with Del Shields and guest professional revolutionary Tom Hayden after station identification. Night Call welcomes your comments about this nationwide listener call-in program. Your opinions and reactions are of value to the producers of Night Call in their continuing attempt to initiate and stimulate dialogue between the black man in the street and his white counterpart. Please address your comments to Night Call, Pomona, New York, zip 10970. That's Night Call, Pomona, New York, zip 10970. The producers of Night Call attempt to balance the points of view presented on this series about controversial issues. In keeping with this traditional concern for free expression on controversial matters, Night Call invites requests for equal time from responsible representatives on opposing points of view if it's thought they have not been adequately represented on the air. Such requests should be addressed to Night Call, Pomona, New York, zip 10970. That's Night Call, Pomona, New York, zip 10970. Ask your own questions direct. Speak for yourself collect from anywhere in North America to guest Tom Hayden about law and order. Call Night Call Collect from the East and Midwest on area code 212-749-3311. From the West on area code 212-749-3357. And from the New York area on 866-5010. Again, Del Shields.
And welcome to the Night Call stations who join us nightly for the second half hour. Tonight, our conversation, what sort of law to maintain, what sort of order. And our guest calling in from San Francisco is Mr. Tom Hayden, a co-founder of the Students for a Democratic Society, and also described in some circles as a professional American revolutionary. This time, we'll take our first call during this half hour from New Jersey. Mr. Graham is hearing Night Call over WLIB-FM. Mr. Graham?
Yes, good
evening.
Yeah, I would like to make a comment, more or less, because I share your point of view, really I do, being a veteran of Vietnam and being a black man. The draft, from your point of view, I really go for, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, I know what you mean.
This is not being anything racial or anything, but I think the draft is unfair, more or less, to the Negroes in America than they are to the white. Do you share my point of view on that?
Yeah.
Okay, now what? Well, I don't know about the West Coast, but what do you think, say, for instance, the white man is going to gain from this war in Vietnam? It's more or less his war.
What do I think he's going to gain from it?
Right.
A bad reputation that he deserves, I think. I think this war has been very good in sort of waking people up around the world to what kind of barbarian behavior power structure the United States is capable of. And the hatred of Johnson and Humphrey and Nixon around the world is very great right now, and even here inside the United States. And everywhere people think that Americans are ugly, and that can maybe make it more difficult for the United States to ever get its hands in a country like Vietnam again. I don't know. That's my only hope.
To Russia, thank you.
Thank you for calling, sir. Thank you. This is Night Call in New York. What sort of law to maintain? What sort of order? Our guest tonight, Mr. Tom Hayden, calling in from San Francisco. Mr. Hayden, do you see the situation in Vietnam relevant to the violence in this country in any way?
Well, you can't watch your television and see people drafted and come home in coffins every day without starting to feel there's some kind of connection. I think that there would be violence in the United States even though, even if there was no Vietnam War, Del, but with the Vietnam War, it gets all the greater. I mean, you cannot, if you're President Johnson or Nixon or Spiro Houzis, you cannot lecture people on to be nonviolent or peaceful while at the same time you're spending $80 billion a year on nuclear weapons, and $30 billion of that 80 is going to sort of deform and destroy the whole civilization and countryside and nature itself in Vietnam. You just, no one will believe you when you tell them that they have to be peaceful, that violence never worked, because the United States government is the greatest teacher and advocate of violence in the world today.
This time we'll go out to Austin, Texas. Mr. Riley is hearing Night Call over KUT-FM. Mr. Riley?
Yes.
Good evening, sir.
Good evening.
Your question?
Yes, my question is, a friend of mine is was involved in the Columbia Revolution, or whatever you want to call it, and in speaking with him, I was informed of many, many incidences and of the issues involved in the protest at Columbia. And this helped to further enhance my suspicion that the public is not really being informed of what is involved in the student movement. And I'd like to just know if SDS is involved in educating the public in just to know better what they're after and what the issues are involved in various things such as Columbia, Berkeley, Vietnam, and so forth.
Yeah, well, we would like very much to be able to give our side of the story or a picture of things as we see them. But, you know, we're up against CBS, ABC, NBC, the New York Times, and all the other papers that are not about to print the truth. Especially when, like in the case of the New York Times, one of its owners is on the board of trustees of Columbia University. And that interfered with the New York Times' ability to print the truth about Columbia. This is, I think, one of the most staggering problems that we have. People get the impression that we're just a bunch of maniacs who don't like our parents for some reason and go around tearing up and disrupting university classrooms and waving red flags, when in fact the reality is much more complicated. You're talking about a group of young people who very gradually come to disagree with their country's policies. We think we're very normal. We think it's the Nixons and the Agnews who are abnormal. But there's no way really to get across our point of view except through action in the very local areas and cities where and campuses where we work. I would say that this is the biggest problem in some ways that we have to deal with in this country, how to get a different side of the story told.
Well, Mr. Hayden, briefly, can we assume that most of the student disturbances across the country are related, or is there some kind of commonality there?
Well, see, even that question is upside down from our point of view. What's related across the country is that the universities teach people how to be good young businessmen, and the universities across the country do secret military research on chemicals and other kind of germs that they use on people in Vietnam, and the universities across the country are helping the agricultural industry in California against the Mexicans who work out in the fields, and they're buying up property in Harlem from people who live there. That's what's related across the United States, a system of education that is not education at all. It's merely sort of a brainwashing machinery to make everybody grow up and believe that America is the greatest place in the world, it has no problems, and should be the policeman for all the people in the world. That's what's related. Secondly, we don't call these student disturbances. That sounds like a belch or some kind of thing that you get from too much drinking. There is a conflict going on across the country against this university establishment, and because the university is nationwide, in fact it's more than nationwide, it's international, you're going to see protests against it on the same basis by students all across the country, students in France, students in West Germany, students in Italy, because they're rebelling against a system that has international machinery. And that's why all these things are related.
Mr. Riley, thank you for calling, sir.
Thank you.
Thank you. This is Night Call in New York, and this time up to Schenectady, New York, where Mr. Kessler is hearing Night Call of WGY-FM. Mr. Kessler?
I'd like to talk to Mr. Hayden about one of his essays that I read in the New Republic collection of Thoughts of Young Radicals, and the essay is entitled The Ability to Face Whatever Comes. Mr. Hayden talks about the fact that people have little decision or active control over decisions and institutions, and he says that a movement should be built wherein the people would be able to contribute in the decision-making process. And I was just wondering, practically speaking, how he thought such a movement could be built and how this value could be operationalized.
It's very difficult, but we don't see any way to change the government and change its policies unless it's done by a big movement of people who want to take decision-making power into their own hands, like the abolitionists did in the 19th century, and the labor movement did in the 19th and 20th centuries, and movement for civil rights by the black people did in the early 1960s. That is coming about in some ways.
Do you think that you will really be able to get such a grassroots movement? People tend to be generally apathetic, and although the tone of the times is get moving, people just don't seem to be moving as much as one would like to believe, at least as much as I see it. And the realization of this value really seems to me pretty far out of the question, just because of the way that society is polarized and everything else. And I don't really think that you can change this basic polarization of society.
Well, the people look apathetic and disinterested all the time, but very often they're ready to move whenever they think that some kind of real change is possible. One of the things that was never really reported about the Columbia University strike, which was the most important thing in many ways, was the life inside of the buildings. You see, when the students took over the buildings, there were 700 to 1,000 students in them, and they lived in there for a week. They went out and bought food and divided up the food, and they held meetings, and they ran off stuff on the mimeograph machine, and they set up...
I appreciate all these things that go on.
In other words, they were heavily participating for the first time in the life of the university.
The fact remains that after they are finished participating...
This was the biggest thing in their lives.
Okay.
Many of them will remember that experience after everything else kind of gets blurred.
At that time, it was the biggest thing in their lives.
It was
almost a passing fancy.
No. If they had not been stopped by the police, they would have, in effect, become the new administration of the university in cooperation with the faculty.
Mr. Kessler, thank you for calling, sir.
Thank you.
This is Night Call in New York, and this time up to Boston, Mr. Kelleher is hearing Night Call of a WBUR-FM. Mr. Kelleher?
Hello. I wanted to sort of go back to something Mr. Hayden said earlier. I'm very concerned about the situation of the draft. And the thing that I don't think he stressed or would have put it in the terms that I would have, I was essentially in agreement with him, but I don't think he stressed enough the fact that he called it individualism, but I would say it was largely our sort of religious background and most Christian teaching, and I don't know Jewish teaching as well as I do Christian teaching, stresses that we... On the issue of killing, we are supposed to make our own decision personally and decide whether a war is worth fighting or not. And this is reiterated again and again. And so there's no other way you can decide about a war. None of the Christian churches have said that all war is bad. they would be in an untenable position in regards to the state if they said that. So each person has to decide for himself. And the current draft law makes this impossible to decide. You have to decide about all wars. And if everyone had to do that, we'd have a fantastic polarization on that issue. So
I completely agree with you. I'm sure the reason that I didn't mention that was, and I'm so used to Christians not ever practicing what they preach that it didn't even cross my mind. But
well, I applied for CO, and I've sort of tried to justify my position in terms of the system because I've always felt that I have to be considerate of the other man who was going to serve.
Yeah.
And a lot of my friends are, you know, either in the reserves or something like that.
Yeah.
And the thing I finally concluded was that everyone should be, the only way you could object, really, for most people, I'm not saying everyone, but for the vast majority of Americans, the only real issue is whether a particular war is just. And an awful lot of people are bothered by that issue. And so that the law is really totally irrelevant for most people. And for the draft people to turn around and say, prove your belief, in fact, I thought that was somewhat of an imposition in itself. I mean, under all our other laws, you're innocent until proven guilty, so to speak.
Right.
And this one, you take a stand that is supposed to be a reasonable one in terms of our ethics and culture, and then you're supposed to justify it in terms of... Well, it's a very difficult thing to prove. It's a personal belief that you hold strongly.
Mr. Kelleher, we want to thank you for calling. We're going to ask Mr. Hayden to respond right after station identification. Thank you for calling, sir. This is Night Call in New York. Stay tuned for the Night Call Network.
More Night Call with Del Shields and guest professional revolutionary Tom Hayden after station identification. Tomorrow night on Night Call, just what is a crime psychiatrist and just what is a psychotic criminal? In fact, just why do criminals behave the way they do? Dr. James Brussel shares his ideas with you from his just published Casebook of a Crime Psychiatrist. Dr. Brussel helped solve such notorious crimes as that of the Mad Bomber, the Wiley murders, the Boston Strangler, and the Coppolino case. He's Assistant Commissioner of Mental Hygiene for the state of New York, and his services have been called on frequently by various police departments, the FBI, and even the Central Intelligence Agency for counter-espionage advice. The Casebook of a Crime Psychiatrist, with the man who helped solve the case of the Boston Strangler and the Mad Bomber, Dr. James Brussel, tomorrow night on Night Call. Ask your own questions direct. Speak for yourself collect from anywhere in North America to guest Tom Hayden about law and order. Call Night Call Collect from the East and Midwest on area code 212-749-3311. From the West on area code 212-749-3357. And from the New York area on 866-5010. Again, Del Shields.
And we return to our guest, Mr. Tom Hayden, calling in from San Francisco as we continue our conversation, what sort of law to maintain and what sort of order. And this time, out to Albuquerque, New Mexico, Mr. Beavers is hearing Night Call over KGGM. Mr. Beavers?
Yes, sir.
Good evening, sir.
Good evening.
Your question?
Yes, to what degree should the average American take law and order into his own hands? In other words, should he only protect what rights directly, I mean, the ones that directly affect him, or what? Which is to what degree?
Mr. Hayden?
I'm not sure I know what you mean.
Well,
you can go further. I think everybody certainly has a right to protect their own home. Everyone has a right to self-defense, but what do you mean beyond that?
Well, an example, something which may affect the entire community. Should anyone take hand in that, or should they simply wait until it directly affects them. Like specific law and ordinances which may not directly affect him because, like, for instance, he may not be involved in this particular case, but it could affect him someday. Like, you know, there are many laws that which we are not directly governed by, but potentially could be. Should we protest against these because they could be a potential restraint against our way of life, or should we just wait until the time comes around for
it? Yeah, I see what you mean. Well, I wish that people would get aroused and interested in things a little bit beyond their front door, because when the trouble gets to your front door, then it's a little too late.
It seems that Americans have always been sort of an isolationist, like who cares until it directly affects them, and I just wondered if you thought this would be the correct attitude.
No, I don't. If you just take the racial situation, out there in the suburbs where the white people live, many white people are not racists, and in no way do they benefit from the poverty and misery that exists down in the ghetto. Yet right out there in the suburbs, there are people living maybe next door to you who own all these slum properties down there, or who go down with these illegally weighted scales in their stores and sell people meat at an inflated high price. And there are city officials who don't do their job. There are policemen who are motivated by some kind of brutal desires, and because of the direct attack and direct injury that these people, who are a minority of the white community, inflict on the black community, all white people will eventually have to pay. And as long as all white people silently sit by and support the deeds and activities of a few white people, then we'll all be judged guilty by the black person.
I understand exactly what you mean. However, I'm not clear on what kind of protest should we make. Should this be a violent or which I just tuned in, and I'm not sure if you're stressing the violent or the non-violent kind of protest. Which is more effective? And doesn't the violent type of protest seem to make one suffer more after they've violated all these restrictions that the laws have placed on them, like chances are you could go to jail or potentially, or you know, suffer losses unaccountable. And I seem to think that maybe a nonviolent protest would be more effective. How do you feel?
Well, nonviolence is always the best thing. The problem is, though, that all of these people who now are lecturing black people to be nonviolent, where were they in the previous 15 or 20 years when all these laws were being trampled and violated in the ghetto?
Well,
if you want to get out of this situation, you have to take preventive action.
Let me close by asking you...
Instead of more military forces in the ghetto, you've got to do something that makes it possible for peaceful protest to work.
Let me close by asking you, do you see any hopeful signs in the near future? Like, do you think that are we running downhill, or is America progressively getting better?
I think both. People whom President Nixon represents are running downhill, although they look like they have the power and the offices, and they look like they're the high and mighty. But in fact, they are sort of passing out because they do not relate to the new trends that are going on in the world. Nixon's daughters and this little David Eisenhower do not relate to what students and young people in this country feel, and they do not relate to what's going on in Europe and in Africa and Asia and Latin America. But I would say that in addition to the black people and the Mexicans who are already in motion and trying to get in touch with new things inside our borders, also the young white people in high schools and some of them in factories, and certainly those in colleges, are trying to be a little more in touch with the 20th century, a little more in touch with the world, and want very much to make it possible for everybody to live as good a life as our technology and industry permits, without any raw deals for anybody. And it's kind of a race between these two Americas. It's not that one group is un-American or anything like that. Though it often appears that the Spiro Agnews and the Richard Nixons and the Lyndon Johnsons represent the majority, I'm not sure that over the next 20 years that that's all so clear, because America's a very young society. The majority of people in this country are under 25 years of age and getting younger all the time. And it's the young people who are never consulted. They do not vote. They cannot vote. When the public opinion pollster comes around, he never interviews anybody under 21. And so young people, black and white, and in the factories and universities, really don't have a very good measure of what their numbers are and what their power is. But I would say it's pretty great, and so I'm very hopeful about that.
Mr. Beavers, thank you for calling, sir.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Bye.
To Indianapolis, Indiana, Mr. Shipley is hearing Night Call over WTLC-FM. Mr. Shipley?
Thank you. Mr. Hayden, I am a citizen in this country at present. I am age 25. I am part of the new awareness movement, if you will, inside the voting age group of the young Americans. I do agree with you there are changes necessary in our society. I do agree with you there are changes necessary in our government. I do not agree, however, that non-voting members of the society should work toward violent or non-violent means that the SDS has apparently done and apparently backs in this present explosive environment, if you will. I think it seems to me that the field of endeavor should be to get the vote down to 18, as many politicians agree, as I agree, as an overwhelming number of students agree at the present time. Once the age limit is down, then the 18-year-olds can be heard. And I think if the college students and the young Americans would concentrate on this effort, we could make ourselves heard, not possibly to the Lyndon Johnsons or the Spiro Agnews,
yeah,
or the Richard Nixons,
right,
but to the Birch Bayes and the Wayne Morrises and our senators and elected congressmen inside the governing body.
Right.
Mr. Shipley, we're going to thank you for calling. We have just about a minute, and we'll ask Mr. Hayden to respond. Thank you for calling, sir.
Well, I haven't emphasized violence as a means. I think that that's sort of a last resort. I think that the violence of the student protesters is minor compared to the violence of the police or the violence of the U.S. and Vietnam. I'm for whatever means are effective, and that could include a lowered voting age to 16 or 18. I'm very much for that. I think you have to remember that giving the right to vote to the black people in the 19th century did not improve their status, and giving the vote to women in 1920 did not improve their status. Both
Mr. Hayden,
groups are in trouble today.
Mr. Hayden, I want to thank you so much for being our guest tonight on Night Call. This is Del Shields in New York. Good night and peace.
Night Call, the first and only nationwide listener call-in show on vital issues. Tomorrow night, same time, same station, The Casebook of a Crime Psychiatrist with Dr. James Brussel. Listen tomorrow night. Discuss freely and responsibly your own personal opinions. Speak for yourself on Night Call. Produced by the United Methodist Church, presented with National Council of Churches, National Catholic Office for Radio and Television, American Jewish Committee, and Urban Coalition.